Two Summers in Guyenne by Edward Harrison Barker. The story of an Englishman's travels as he journeyed through the Guyenne during the summer of 1892 and 1893. Selected passages. Part 1, Fénelon. I was on my way to the castle where Fénelon first saw the light, and in order to reach it, I had to cross the river. An old flat-bottomed boat, built for conveying men, asses, and other animals from one side to the other, lay off the bank, and two girls, who were in charge of a flock of geese, as well as of the ferry, were willing to take me across. While the elder ferried, the younger examined me carefully at close quarters, and apparently with much interest. Presently, she asked me if I sold writing paper. After landing, I soon reached the village of Saint-Mondan. Here I halted at the inn in the shadow of old walnut trees. A few yards off, under one of the great trees, was a high wooden crucifix, around which some 20 or 30 geese were standing or lying down, all in a digestive or contemplative mood. And through the openings between the boles and the branches were seen the sunlit meadows sloping to the low willows and the flashing river. From Saint-Mondan, a charming road or lane between very high banks that are almost cliffs leads upward to the Château de la Motte Fénelon, where in 1651 was born François de Salignac de la Motte, known to the world as Fénelon. Having reached the top of the hill, I soon came in view of a picturesque mass of masonry with round towers capped with pointed roofs and with Gothic gables hanging lightly in the air over dormer windows, the whole rising out of a dense grove of trees in the midst of a quiet sunny landscape. When quite near, I found the grove was a sombre little wood of evergreen oaks. The same wood, if not the actual oaks, may have been there in Fénelon's time, for the ilex is one of the commonest trees in Périgord on the hills about the Dordogne. As a boy, while climbing here, he may have torn his hose into tatters, notwithstanding his precocious knowledge of Greek. The future churchman may even have robbed a jay's nest on this very spot. What quietude and what deep shadow! Not a leaf stirred. Only a fiery shaft of sunshine forced its way here and there through the dark roof of unchanging green to the brown soil and the rampart's mossy wall. Although the present castle was raised when feudalism was nothing more than a tradition and a sentiment, the outworks, consisting of two walls, the inner one standing on ground considerably higher than the other, were of exceptional strength. And as they were originally, so they remain at the present day. I passed through the outer and then the inner gateway, and, in my search for a human being, accident led me to the kitchen, which was very large and entirely paved with pebbles. Here I found the cook, who, I had been told, was the only person in authority at that time. Surrounded by four great walls, on which hung utensils that were rarely handled except for the periodical scouring, she looked as solemn as a cloistered nun. She consented, however, to show me the interior of the castle with a pathetic readiness which said that the appearance of an occasional visitor kept her from sinking into hopeless melancholy. The most interesting room is the one in which Fénelon slept. Here is to be seen his four-post bedstead, each of the posts a slender twisted column, the silk hangings and fringe looking very worn and faded after being exposed to the light of over 200 years. Adjoining this room is the salle à manger, the immense hearth with seats at the ingle corners, being covered by an elliptical arch. Most of the furniture here and elsewhere is of massive oak, carved in the style of the 17th and 18th centuries. The family into whose possession this castle has passed, although distinct from that of Salignac de la Motte, which has now no representative, reverently preserves all that associates the spot with the memory of the illustrious author of Tillimack. From the top of one of the machicolated towers, I saw a vast expanse of country, singularly grand, but very solemn. From each side of the Dordogne Valley rose and stretched away into the distance a seemingly endless succession of hills, broken up by narrow gorges and glens. Over all, or nearly all these hills, lay a dark and scarcely varying mantle of forest. This tract of country is well named Périgord Noir. It is one of the few districts of France which still draw a sum from the government, yearly, in the form of prize money for the wolves that are killed there.